but it will come to them in the form of a divine foolishness. It'll come to them with, you know, the language, stammering lips, another tongue, is language that was spoken about of other nations that would come down with a darker speech and so forth. It was idiomatic for a Gentile, really, a foreigner. And here, it wouldn't be fair. Well, we'll look at Isaiah 28, but...
the foolishness cuts both ways, because for the church, it's the foolishness of seeing God in the Jews that have not yet turned.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. It's all of that.
It goes both ways.
It's foolishness both ways.
It's both ways. And so, exactly, the stone of Zion kills all the birds.
Right.
It deals with the church, it deals with the nations, and it deals with the Jew.
It diminishes all boasting.
Right. On the one hand, the controversy of Zion is God's controversy with the nations who come down. And like Jesus says, if you don't fall on the stone, it's going to fall on you.
Right.
When you take up the burden of Jerusalem as the nations, it's going to cut you in pieces.
God.
On the other hand, I have a controversy with my people. So Jews, you're going to have an again and again and again until we resolve this issue of righteousness. What is the true basis, source, and character of the righteousness that's acceptable with me? It's got to be my own righteousness. I perfected that in your Messiah. That's never going to be found. The Spirit could not lawfully indwell you unless he did so on the basis of the blood of my Son. And we've got to show that the Spirit will not cohabit with confidence in the flesh concerning your own righteousness. He will not. He resists that. That's called pride.
If he wouldn't betray Jesus.
That's right.
Well, he would not betray the work of Christ.
Well, he'll testify of Christ and no one else. And so, unless your righteousness is the righteousness of God provided through Christ, which, by the way, even the Old Testament believers had, they could never... They could have never taken up their first conversation with God if he had not had the surety of that everlasting blood as already done. It was a done deal before it was done, historically. That's why, even though he had not yet revealed it, he was mediating his salvation on no other basis, albeit the secondary basis was through faith. And you know, but the Spirit could not indwell any fallen man lawfully unless there was a complete perfume of perfect righteousness. And that's found nowhere but in Jesus. God will accept no other righteousness but his own. He'll reward no other righteousness of his own. But the works were never the Lord's. Even he never did his own works. Had he done one work, good work, on his own, it would have been as if he sinned. The golden thread of his redemptive authority would have been broken. Had he done one thing, even a good thing, on his own. That's how jealous God is of this issue of righteousness. And it will have no mixture of man. No man doesn't get in on the virgin birth. Man doesn't get in on anything. You know, it's a precluding of not humanity, but a fallen perverse thing that man is in himself. So powerful. This is how to build this case and make it clear. I know the Jews are going to hear it from Gentiles, and we'll see why. Look at verse 28. Chapter 28.
Wait a minute. Isaiah what?
Isaiah 28. What we're going to, I'm assuming you want to expound the stammering tongue.
Exactly. And we have to remember, we've just now come out of a completely, what's called the little apocalypse that begins in 24. So this is very heavily eschatological. And does eschatological things have a down payment, an installment,
sure.
And pass?
Right.
Of course.
No,
when we understand, when we talk about an Assyrian, we're not just talking about a local, you know, contemporary ruler in the 8th century. We're talking about a type. And this type is a coming Antichrist. And he's also called the Chaldean. So how can you be a Chaldean and an Assyrian? The issue is not... Assyria doesn't nail down his locality any more than Chaldea nails.
Right.
But these are the great types. You know, seven heads and all. These are the great types of the coming ultimate Antichrist. So I'm going to say that verse 2 here. Well, let's start reading verse 1. Woe to the crown of pride to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower which are on the head of the valleys of those who are overcome with wine. We're going to see why they're overcome with wine here. Behold, the Lord has a mighty and strong one, who like a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, like a flood of mighty waters overflowing. All the language of Daniel apply to the Antichrist, the flood, the whole thing. The strong one here, Jeremiah will talk about the yoke of a cruel one, another strong one. This is language for a final Antichrist.
Yeah, right.
Well, the aggressor from the north, the ultimate and final aggressor before what? Before the redemption. See, the issue of the redemption is your line of demarcation. You'll find comparative language through similar phrases that will line you up. You'll be able to always detect the proximity of things in relation to the day of the Lord, whether this side or that side of the day of the Lord. And you have to distinguish, like if you have a contemporary partial fulfillment, But it requires a further exhaustive Day of the Lord climax that issues in the redemption. Oh, well, then you know you just you're actually compelled to not just confine it to a past history, or you've got a failure of prophecy. You've got high hopes built upon the end of some crisis that just never happened. And that's what the liberals think, of course. So this is the Antichrist here, brothers. This is what I believe. And so this mighty one is the Antichrist. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trampled underfoot. There's the 42 months of the trotting down.
Yep.
Yes, it's happened many times before. Rome, Babylon, Antiochus, etc. But here it is at the end, just before the eschatological conclusion.
That's
we'll
Revelation
see that.
11.
Yeah. Yep. And the glorious beauty, verse 4, which is on the head of the fat valley, shall be a fading flower. Now notice, interesting here, Ezekiel 38 shows that when the Antichrist comes down. Now, why do I know it's the Antichrist? Because verse 17 of Ezekiel 38 says, "Are you the one of whom I've spoken in old time by all my servants, not just Ezekiel, not just a northern invader that Ezekiel's coming up with, but this is the guy, you're the guy that all my prophets spoke about in all those years, many years, that I would bring you against my people in the latter days." Who can that be but the Antichrist?
Right.
So Gog is the Antichrist. Gog is also Satan. He is the chief prince in the sense that Michael's a chief prince. The demon Satan will be the energizing, animating spirit of the Antichrist. But he's still around. He's bound, but he's still around for the end, too. So we can talk about a Gog later, too. This is the Antichrist. The Antichrist invasion of Israel, here's the point I'm making, finds Israel, a disobedient people, about to be chastened with Jacob's trouble, but guess what? They're prospering. In fact, so much so, they've excited the attention and the covetousness of the northern invader. And all these nations he brings down with him upon what? A prosperous nation. So the scriptures all show that Jacob's trouble comes to a nation that have been recently restored. Gather yourselves together, O nation not desired. Not only so, but they've come out of many generations from the sword, 70 AD, 132 AD, and now they're gathered back against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste continually. This is the long exile. So the long exile issues in a recovery of the land. They're back under their own power, but God's too, of course. The providence of God fulfills prophecy, significantly back. They're not just incidentally back, but they prosper. Jake, this is very important for the guy. How could God bring us all back and then just to scatter us again? Because the scripture everywhere shows that Jacob's trouble comes to a people that are in the land, have been there for some time, but only recently there. Ezekiel 38, verse 8 says, you just got back, and no sooner have you got back, this guy notices you're getting pretty wealthy there. And now he comes down. Well, see, that fits perfectly with the language and the conceptualization of Isaiah. So look at this. He's coming down to a glorious beauty, a fat valley, but it's about to be turned to a charred desolation. It's about to be turned to just incredible, shocking desolation. So this is not desolations of many, many generations. This is there's the long desolation. You've got to remember, just like your short and long day, you've got your long desolation from 170, 132 in that area to 1948. Then you've got a prospering, and then you've got a short desolation, an intensive, unparalleled desolation of only a mere 3.5 years. And the fact is, what makes it so hard on this question of the order of the return is most of the prophecies about the return presuppose a post-tribulational glory of redemption, but they confuse those. And so there's so many prophecies that show that the desolation ends with a return, and they think, well, we've had the desolation, now we've got the return. How could there be another desolation and another return? By failing to distinguish that, there is a lot of confusion that just can't conceive that this return is not permanent.
It's the pattern of Messiah.
Yeah.
Appears, cut off, appears.
Right. Just remember, it's a prosperous Israel, not one that's just come back and, you know, draining swamps. This assumes a real prosperity in the midst of the earth. And just like many times, when did the prophets come many times threatening of judgment? It was when Jeshua had waxed fat. Yeah, in other words, just the fact that you're doing so well does not mean you're doing so well. So, verse 5, or going on there with verse 4, it's all about to be eaten up. In that day shall the Lord of hosts be a crown of glory. Now here establishes a clearly eschatological context. So watch out about putting all this back with Assyria. This is language for the redemption. See what I mean? In that day shall the Lord of hosts be for a crown of glory and for a diadem of beauty unto the residue of his people, for a spirit of justice to him that sits in judgment, and for strength to those who turn the battle to the gate. This is the glorious promise of a transition that comes at the very end. But now we're going to backdrop and talk about a covenant with death and hell. You know how the prophets are. They'll talk about their... There's only one way to get chronology in the Scripture. It has nothing to do with verse order. It's only the language that you... It groups around a motif or a theme. And that's the only way. Because sometimes you'll have... We just saw the day where there was one verse in the middle of Hosea 8 that sounded very redemptive. There was terror above and terror below. And here's this insertion of, I'll gather you, and thus... So, you know, kind of... But that was an extreme case. I'm not even sure about our interpretation. But what I am clear on, and you all know, you've seen it many times, is how often Jeremiah will interrupt a very severe judgment with a glorious promise of consolation and redemption, right, then go right back to hammering the Jews again. So, verse 6, the spirit of justice. All right, verse 7, but they also have erred through wine, and this is a spirit of stupor. This isn't like physical wine, I'm sure. Through strong drink and are out of the way. So it's a spirit of presumption, of intoxication, of deception, of delusion. The priest and the prophet have erred through strong drink. They are swallowed up of wine. They eat. They are out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that there is no place clean. Now we're going to come back to this. Why is he saying all tables? The reason is because the vision is more than they can handle. It actually turns them to wine, to anesthetize themselves of the terror that's in front of them. Remember over there in Isaiah, it says, don't fear their fear. Don't see a confederacy. Well, they're going to be fearing. They're going to see the gathering against them, you know. And again, we're not dealing with strict chronology here. So all tables are full of vomit assumes what we're about to see, that the covenant with death and hell has been broken, and the overflowing scourge, which they denied was coming, they dismissed it as threatening, has now come. So this is kind of a leap forward, verse 8, at a time when it will be a vexation to even understand the report. It'll be hard to even, you know, wrap your head around it. The covers are more narrow than you can wrap themselves. The bed's shorter. There's total uncomfort, discomfort, total inability to really come to any rest with this. So he's going to say here, but here's, in the place where there is no rest, there will be rest. And here's we're going to get to that. Verse 9. Now here's this thing about milk and meat we started with today, brothers. We started with the issue of the meat in due season. Well, here it is. Verse 9. Whom shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? This, brothers, is the masculine. This is the mystery among my disciples. This is the one that's understanding and instructing many. To whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Those that are weaned from the milk, drawn from the breast. This is the language behind our New Testament writers, Paul and Peter and Jesus. For precept must be upon precept, line upon line, line upon line. Now, I think the NIV really does some unfortunate things here. It makes this almost like it's just gibberish and it will seem as nothing, but what I think this is saying in the King James Version, in my favorite translation here, is that, and it can be properly translated. There's a legitimate translation, but there is a choice. And I favor the choice that the translators of the KJV made here. I'm not dealing with legitimacy. I'm dealing with, right, you know, the right couple ways you could go contextually, what the bigger... God is saying here, there is a hidden puzzle in the Old Testament, right, that will be a consummate apologetic that will be set before this scornful people. They will dismiss it and put it from them, but it will have been compelling. It will have been some substantial evidence which makes sense out of what they've gone through as a people historically and what they're about to go through again. You with me?
Yep.
So, for with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people. In other words, this is Gentiles. Now notice, this is not the invasion. Like, I'm going to speak to you through an invasion by a foreigner.
That's the part I wanted to get.
The reason that's wrong is because this is before the covenant with death has been broken. This is warning them that they are in a jeopardy here of enduring a great invasion.
This is coming to them
to warn them that this is like watchmen on the wall that are telling them, you have made a covenant with death and hell. And they said, no, we haven't. It's not yet come.
So it's not just a foreboding army. We can actually pull it out of that context and say,
I suppose, and if I was a contemporary scholar and I was in that mindset, I would probably favor what you're talking about.
I don't favor it.
Yeah, I know you don't. I know you're trying, exactly, me too. I understand, and that's why I appreciate this. And but look at this. Let's read on. This is time. There's still time to give the good news of a refreshing and a rest. I don't have to urge on you the fact this is clearly language for the gospel. So this is not just a mystery of an end time line of events or something. This is the mystery of Christ and of Israel, the gospel, right? This is more than just you're about to enter. But notice that this reasoning that comes is line upon line, and it comes with stammering lips, and it's precept upon precept. That if there's a coming Assyrian army, it hasn't got here yet, is my point. See, I think that cannot therefore be, because if you're going to make the invasion of the army, the people of a foreign language invading you, and you're going to make that the compelling argument, it hasn't happened yet. This presupposes that this is a ministry of warning that's coming before. So look at this here. In that day, we were there. All right. Now, you know what? I'm making a case here, or I think you can too, Samuel, that the stammering, the testimony is coming through stammering lips, not just in terms of a foreign army when it arrives.
Right.
And I would even say even as it's threatening, because remember, they are secure. They are not expecting this. They're not being intimidated by something threatening.
That's a great point.
Yeah. See, the more we get the pieces lined up and hold them fast, even though for a while they create an antinomy or a paradox, they resolve in glorious revelation. But see, you're seeking out a mystery. You're staying with it. You're like a bulldog. You're on the trail, and you're holding this over here. Now, wait a minute. They've got to be secure. They're not expecting this. So so they could not be intimidated. You're not just say, here's the refreshing. Don't be afraid of the Assyrian. He's going to come, and God's speaking to you right now through this threat. No, they're like saying, there's a threat here that you don't even conceive of. In your presumption, you're saying it won't happen to you. And this is coming to you line upon line, here a little and there a little. And it's more than just you're going to go through Jacob's trouble. This is the testimony of your Messiah. This is the righteousness of God. This is the rest of a righteousness and a rest that's forever.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
This is incredible language.
No, we're there.
To whom he said, verse 12, this is the rest. I love that. Refreshing. Yet they would not hear, because they were secure. They're not scared. They're totally secure. You idiots, you Gentile Christian madmen, you're coming to us with this mystery sealed among my disciples, and it's the sealed vision. We're going to see in Isaiah 29, this is the sealed vision. That's exactly, brothers, the sealed vision that Daniel says will be the masculine of the end. You can't extricate this and put it just back in contemporary. It's definitely eschatological. It brings you to the end of the tribulation, the resurrection of the dead. Mm-hmm. You've got to keep letting these things line up. See, Matthew 24 with Daniel is the great aligner.
Yeah.
It lets you go back. Those key verses, especially Daniel, Matthew 24 sends you to Daniel. That aligns you. It allows you to go ahead and see an authoritative. That's why, except for the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and even it doesn't equal, there is no greater attack by liberal modern theology on any part of the Bible than Daniel. Satan is terrified of Daniel, brothers. I used to say, in a little bit of a lightness, but it's true, I said the downfall of the devil, how did I say it, John?
Determinism.
The downfall of the devil is in the details of Daniel through divine determinism.
Yikes. Tweet that one.
Yeah, unpack that one too. So look, I'm trying to come to a quick conclusion so we can get back to the Olivet Prophecy and not completely disappoint our agenda. But let's see.
Like our Mexican lunch, we expected a detour. So
we're drawn from the mill. Brothers, this is the meat and due season. You seeing this? This is apocalypse evangelism. This is bringing the testimony of the prophecies, using Christ's judgment, all that to appeal to the refuge that's only found where? In the righteousness of God through Christ. No other righteousness is acceptable. I don't care how many babbles of temples and sacrifices and obedience.
Which is the rest.
Yeah.
False rest.
They fear God. The man outside of Christ is capable of almost anything. It's almost like the two snakes of Pharaoh. They could so nearly imitate the one. But there's that something other that keeps it short of the glory. But the righteousness of Christ is the glory of God. So there's something that the Jew can so nearly imitate in terms of the external fear of God, love of God, obedience, all that, but it's in the realm of what's possible to man. And God is saying, I require a righteousness that's beyond anything you can conceive, because I know that your condition is way beyond anything you can conceive.
Is there an underlying accusation in 10, 11, and 12 that he did try to offer them milk, or excuse me, he did try to offer them meat, but they simply stuck with the milk? It was the superficial reading of the word, or the superficial call to the covenant.
They did not penetrate on into the mystery.
Yeah, and then, so when he comes back the second time and repeats that phrase, he says, look, the very thing that could have given you life, you actually find it burdensome.
Well, that's a reasonable application. Paul reprimanded the church, as you guys should be into the meat, but you're still hanging in the milk. And, but there again is the analogy. But this is particularly talking about those that he will sit, though they be from another language, the Gentile witness that will be to Israel, the testimony, which Paul puts very near to the proclamation or the mystery, the testimony of the gospel will be through the lips of Gentiles who will penetrate beyond the milk into the meat. This is deep. This is that God is testing Israel over something that is indeed deep. It's available, but it is something that requires revelation. But it's not just revelation out of the blue. It's the dogged persistence to seek all the heart and meaning of God in the Scriptures, and to draw out of the Scriptures an apologetic that shows, wait a minute, you know God has hidden His face from your people all this time. You know God has driven you from one nation to another, and you know that you're in exile. You may think that there's a few righteous rabbis, but that's not enough. Only when your people will be all righteous in the land, only then will the redemption come. Until then, we're in a state of exile. You know, and so why is God dealing this? What means the heat of this anger? What's all this about? What's all the Holocaust about for your people? And God has got a contention with you. You have never been obedient to the covenant as a nation. That's why your tenure in the land will always be under jeopardy. It's your tenure in the land, would you not agree, Rabbi, whoever you are, is only as good as your people are compliant and obedient to the covenant. But there may be times even of prosperity in the land, but that does not immunize you from the threat of fatal judgment. But for you to lie down in safety and be secure forever, like the prophets promise, and inherit the land forever, something's got to give. Something big's got to come. And would you not agree? And your own rabbis talk about the footsteps of Messiah, the pangs of the messianic woes. Yeah. Would you not agree there's a great travail and transition that must come, so that not just a few of you are righteous, but you're all righteous? So you've got something dramatic to go through if the Scriptures are to be taken at all literally. That has not come because you're not that righteous nation yet. The Word of God is not content with a few black-coated men out here representing, you know, God in the exile.
That's good.
You with me?
The gospel is first put to the Jew, then to the Gentile.
It's too low a view.
It's too low a view of what God's after and what God will have. He will not stop short. He will pursue you unto the end of your power until you have come and said, I'm Jacob, I'm a schemer. He'll change your name corporately. You'll enter in. Meantime, there is a masculine. Who is the masculine is a good question. Who's the remnant? How could we ever imagine it would be Gentiles? But didn't he tell you he would make you jealous with another people? Didn't he tell you that while he's hiding your face, there's a secret? We're simply proclaiming unto you the secret, which your own prophets said would come, and which Daniel said would be sealed till the time of the end. Brothers, it's time of the end. You know, clock. It's time of the end. You're in a covenant with death and hell. Your hand's in a bear trap. And this is a continuum, an inveterate tendency to trust in yourself. You know, it's not just that it's a covenant, it's not even just that it's with the Antichrist. It's that it's a historic condition of trusting the flesh with the best of religious intentions. God will not accept it. On the cross, he said no to your righteousness. He said no to mine. Now remember, he's just mentioned up here in verse 10, precept was precept. Now notice the rhythm here. They're going to say, forget it. They're going to dismiss this. Then he says, but it's the rest, it's refreshing. But the word of the Lord, verse 13, was unto them. And he goes right back, like hammering. Precept of, you see the steady, you see the rhythm here, brothers? The word of the Lord was unto them. Just like he said earlier, precept on precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Why? That it might expose them. That they might go backward and be snared and taken. Not to their final damnation necessarily, but to their utter humbling. This is the dismantling of their presumption. This is the great detonation of their pride. This is the deconstruction is the word I'm looking at. It's the deconstruction of their pride. So that they might have heard this, so that when this word, this incredible word coming from this incredible foolish people, but it's compelling, But it's dismissed as though it were gibberish. Because it's not Hebrew, it's not what's the word? It's not kosher, it's not qualified, it's not sophisticated, it's not academic, it's whatever. But it's a spiritual word of a mystery that's here a little and there a little. It depends on key words like until and this same here. And you're showing them, you're reasoning with them out of the scriptures. Apparently God likes that. God likes you up against an impossible, formidable Jew reasoning with him out of his own scriptures. There's something about that. All I can tell you is I can't prove this, but I know God likes it. That's all I just know. So
first century apostles did.
Yeah, they did it all the time.
Stephen did.
And I am saying, I could show you a case from Isaiah 28, Romans 16, a lot of things, that this is the method of evangelism that God has chosen, and we've chosen other methods. He's got a way of doing evangelism. Now, does he bless other things? No question. He's got a way of doing evangelism that pleases him. It's like a certain pleasure. When evangelism is carried on from the standpoint of to the Jew first, out of his own Old Testament scriptures, the writings of the prophets, presented as a mystery contained in the Old Testament writings. That's the key. Now, let me quote it in Romans again. Yeah, exactly. You have all the examples in Acts.
And Peter.
The Acts examples, everything, it's always about apologetics from the scriptures, but you have the methodology or theology of the method in Romans 16. And if I can remember it by my memory, let me go. Now, according to him that is able to establish you, according to my gospel, which is according to the revelation that was kept secret since the beginning of the world, but is now made manifest, and through the scriptures of the prophets made known to all nations to effect an obedience of faith. Check it out if you want to in your translations.
Yeah,
am I slipping something in here, brother? If I'm not saying that an obedience of faith is affected by a chosen method of making known a mystery which has only lately been revealed, but can be every whit confirmed in the Old Testament prophets, and this is what will be making the nations obedient.
No, that's...
This is the forerunner thing we're talking about. It's returning to apostolic evangelism. Apocalypse evangelism. See what I mean? It's a here a little and there a little. Now, there will be streamlined, short versions of this and more elaborate ones. There'll be, you know, I'd like to even see some of this in tracts even, you know, where issues of a trembling Jerusalem is brought directly to bear upon the gospel and how urgent it is that we be covered in the day that's coming. We're going to be an apocalyptic people, even well before. Because, by the way, just because, like my daughter says, Jacob's trouble is not the only trouble. Mm-hmm. There's a beginning of sorrows. Apocalypticism is the name of the game. Even well before, and if we're coming to the end of the 2 days, we may have a decade or two of trouble before the trouble. Yeah. And just because a trouble like no other is coming does not mean a tremendous reconfiguration of nations well in advance. I mean, it's a presumption to think that we're going to have a status quo. Yeah. Why Israel may go, you know, when you think of the kinds of political landscape and conditions that would have to be so radically altered for the Islamic world to, for one moment, countenance a Jewish access to the Temple Mount, well, you're already right there talking about who knows what.
Yeah.
Seismic stuff.
Yeah.
So let's not just say that we become apocalyptic when Jacob's trouble gets here, for crying out loud. Now's the time. Paul said, well before Jerusalem was destroyed, the whole world is about to come under a great distress. He was right. Now, whether or not he thought that was the second coming, I don't know. But I know he says, for the present distress, let those that buy as though they bought not. Well, we're there. From the time that the church began, I shouldn't use that word either, but from the time that the Spirit fell at Pentecost until the Jews really did flee to Pella, you know, when the Romans were coming, there was what? How long was that? 37 years. Not even 40. 37 years, approximately, from Pentecost to the siege of Jerusalem. That's not long, brother. A lot of guys, that's half a lifetime to some of the older, really rare cases of longevity. That's not even a generation. And here is Paul saying the present distress. John had just got through saying flee from the wrath to come. That's still coming. And refuge in Jesus because Jacob's trouble's coming. You better flee. You know what will? It's all in a Jacob's trouble, an imminent tribulation context. That's how they saw it. So they had to get the move on. They had to reach the nations. You know what I mean? So what I like to say, I put it this way, I've said it many times, they lived and labored and witnessed under the cloud of an impending, not imminent, but impending destruction of Jerusalem. That's where we are. We've come full circle.
Well,
We're there, only we're all 10 asleep.
Right.
See, they were wide awake, we're sound asleep. And yet we're right here with a trembling Jerusalem in an era of conflict that's not going to sit there forever without exploding.
So 10 virgins, okay, never mind.
All 10 were asleep,
yeah.
Even the godly. There was a sudden awakening, and then there was a midnight call. That's the forerunner ministry. The midnight call
for sure.
To wake the sleeping giant for the last thrust of an evangelist that will reap a harvest of innumerable. Now, that's not just tribulation. The church has always been a tribulation people, but in the Greek, there's an interesting use of the double article for emphasis. It's rare. It always means heavy emphasis, so it would be translated the tribulation, the great one. Not just tribulation in general, but the 3.5 years. That is going to be the greatest harvest of souls the world's ever seen. The completion of the house is going to coincide with an incredible harvest, and it will end and climax in the resurrection of the nation of Israel. And you will so appreciate now when we come to this, because this is deep stuff. Now we've come out of verse 13, and we've shown that something compelling has comes that makes the Jews very accountable and very reprehensible for their dismissal of it. And there he says in verse 14, and this is what we just now come to because of Samuel's comments. Wherefore, because of this, hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men that rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Who are they scorning? The prophetic witness. They're scorning the forerunner company. You see that they're scorning the watchman on the wall who happened now to be Gentile. You're scorning what? You're scorning the testimony that a covenant is about to be broken. It's going to bring to the trampling underfoot of Jerusalem promised in all the prophets. See what I mean? And you're dismissing it, you're discounting it. And I'm saying this, if we have an inviolability of Zion type of view, that Jerusalem cannot be overrun and it cannot be downtrodden, I don't care if we're Christians, we are siding with a spirit that will be in the scornful men. It's been,
wow.
You with me? We're in a deep, deep place.
The scornful spirit is a huge
and
point.
I don't think you'll go to hell, but if you stick around in Jerusalem when you should be leaving...
It's unnecessary casualty.
It's an unnecessary casualty. Your presumption has ended your life prematurely.
Is it the scoffing thing?
It is the scoffer.
It's the scoffer of the... Yeah. Peter's scoffing spirit.
Yeah, it's a dismissal. Yeah. But it's not denying the coming of the Lord or anything like that. It's denying that a recently restored Jerusalem with a new house and a new sanctuary... We've had it only a little while. And you're telling us we've been gathered back and now all this? Miracles have happened. See, we've got these wonderful videos against all odds. We see the amazing stories of Israel. Now you add to that, suppose even now another near success of another battle. You know, they've got to still be there so the Arabs don't prevail.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to have another success even. And then on top of that, a covenant that'll put so much, that will allow the Arab world to be in such a place of negotiation where they're not now, that they will concede, not willingly, but necessarily, to a Jewish access to the Temple Mount, plotting all the while against it, of course, as we're going to see in Daniel 11 sometime, hopefully.
It's going to make our preaching seem so foolish.
It's going to make us look like complete idiots.
It's going to get worse. 10 times worse.
And even with the Messianics in the land, we have an optimistic view. And I know brothers right now who are expecting even Christian participation at the temple and everything else. I'm telling you guys, the word is the issue of death before the resurrection, a nation that must come to the end of its power. If you don't have those key things, if you don't see the danger of idolatry based upon a human perception of God's election and righteousness, that's got to come down.
It's suffering
if
servant.
You don't understand that, yeah, the suffering servant, if you don't see that image... With Israel, so that it will be a raised nation out of the absolute degradation of Jacob's trouble to become a light to the nations, coming out of an actual death, not just a little bit of sickness. Scornful men who rule this people, Jerusalem. He says, because you have said, verse 15, we have made a covenant with death and with Sheol, we are aggrieved. Now, they're not calling it that, of course. Obviously, this is what, in essence, they've done. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through that you Gentile witnesses with the line upon line, when that will pass through, we know it will not come unto us. We have made, and then God puts this in their mouth because this is their real condition, we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. But your cover is about to be blown, see? So verse 16, we're back to the gospel. We had the gospel in verse 12, which is what I'm saying, verse 10 and verse 13 really is the gospel, this line upon line mystery that is the gospel. Here clearly in verse 16, again, the language that the New Testament uses, taking it right from here, Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. You see that? There is, that is Jesus. That's the stone of stumbling in Isaiah 8. This is the, this is what the prophets of the New Testament understood. Verse 17, justice I will also lay to the lion, and righteousness to the plummet, and hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and waters shall overflow the hiding place. And your covenant with death and hell shall be annulled, and your agreement with Sheol shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then you shall be what? Trodden down or trampled down by it. That's Revelation 11, 2. That is the abomination that makes desolate, the trampling underfoot of Isaiah, of Daniel 8. That's that concentrated. This is the short desolation. This is the tribulation.
Isaiah 63.
So in the middle of the week,
right.
So therefore the witness, the forerunners, are talking to them in the first half of the week. You see the point? And now they've rejected that. And now what was prophesied has come in the middle of the week, and now they're having to deal with it.
And so so we can take all these verses, in my mind, I'm making them completely Jerusalem-centric.
Yeah.
With greater application in general.
Of course, but they're totally Jerusalem-centric, of course. Yeah. It assumes Jerusalem is there. It assumes the sanctuary is there. It's assumed the temple is there for an abomination to be placed in it, for an Antichrist to go to it. And they're receiving witness that they have entered into a covenant that has terrible portent. It hasn't come yet. They're hearing of it. It's being warned. They're being threatened and warned of what's about to happen. And they've dismissed that. They've scorned that. It has come. And now the overflowing, and now the trotting underfoot for the 42 months has come. And there you have it.
So it's the point of the replay.
We don't have to read the rest of it.
The Jeremiah scenario. A replay of the Jeremiah scenario. You're clinging to Jerusalem.
Right.
Instead of cooperating. And in the balance is loss of life, collateral damage, everything, because you cling to...
Well, there's a little difference. You know, what we were saying a while ago, Titus goes home to become the emperor of Rome, right?
Right.
The Antichrist is destroyed by the spirit of his mouth. The Antichrist gave them no warning, did not offer them anything. He comes down presumptuously upon the land of the covenant, and it's considered a war or a violation of the covenant. Right. I call it the war on the covenant. So we'll see this in Daniel 11, where this is actually called the Holy Covenant. So when the Antichrist comes down, he's crossed a line. God's fury comes up in his face. This is the final contention. So that's why the Antichrist is destroyed without remedy, because the Jews here, no matter how reprehensible their condition spiritually is, nobody's given them a chance. It comes in one day. They've been secure, falsely so. Their presumption has reached to heaven. We understand that. But when this guy comes down, there's no negotiations. He hits the land and it's over that quick, and he overruns everything. So God says, I see that, and it's over for you, buddy. In other words, I'm giving you your short time, which fulfills the mystery of iniquity. But when it's over, it's over. And it's over for Israel in a good way. It's over for you in a final, and all those who take your mark, and all those who... So I think there's some difference here between past patterns. You know,
but there seems to me to be the current running thread from 586, 80, 70, all the way along, to not cling to Jerusalem.
Oh, totally. Yeah, now that I'm
100%. That's the main one I'm pulling on. Jeremiah had other issues, but one of his main messages was you're clinging to a temple in Jerusalem as if those things will save you. And I'm telling you, I've sent Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah. In other words, get out of Jerusalem. But Jeremiah was actually saying you can get along with the Babylonians. There's a way. They're not here to destroy you. The Antichrist is here to spare no one.
Right.
So you don't plan to go into some other country and cohabit with Arabs.
No.
What you need to do is hide, because he says in Isaiah, for a little moment till the indignation be overpassed. Go find some chambers, go find some holes in the rocks.
But it's a major point to me to not cling to Jerusalem, because that's the issue that even pulling Zechariah 14:2 in.
Because Jerusalem is part...
In an unholy way of going, therefore, I'm going, but it's still a scary scenario. Yeah.
Jerusalem is part of that Jewish idolatry.
Right.
That must come down. And that is, by the way, infected. Let's at least say it has the potential to infect even saved believers.
Right. And that's where you have to go to the faith of Abraham in Hebrews 11 to say, though I'm in the land, I'm still going to wait for a city to come down.
Yeah, yeah.
a city who's going to make it.
As long as Israel's outside of Christ, how can you believe they're going to have peace? Well, they think, well, you know, the nations are outside of Christ. They cripple along. You know, they have revivals and they come and go and all. Yeah, but this is different. We've come back after many generations to a land. We've got prosperity. Next thing on the horizon is Gog and Magog, which happens to be the Antichrist. He doesn't just come down and suddenly get destroyed on the mountains of Israel. He has 42 months of absolute success. Arms stand on his part. Who can make war with him?
Right.
You know. That's all I really wanted to cover as far as now. I'm totally free and open. I'm not even tired, so it's up to you guys. If you want to take a break or what.